So this is how one gets away with big lies. But here I want to raise a deeper question. What are the lies for? By this I do not mean what is the psychological disposition of the people who tell such lies, but rather what do they gain by telling them? What is the ultimate game plan of the liars? What ugly truths are they trying to camouflage through the lies that they tell? My main objective is not merely to expose lies about white supremacy, but to tell a new story of the making of the Democratic Party. We all know about the Democratic Party as it is. Very few people know how it became this way. My story is a novel genealogy of American politics that exposes the progressive left, together with its political arm, the Democratic Party, as the party of the plantation, the party of enslavement. The plantation, viewed as a complete ecology involving exploited inhabitants, rented overseers, and the plantation boss or massa running things from the big house, defines the Democrats not merely in the past, but also in the present. Part of the interest of this book is to see how this system in modified fashion operates today, with new bosses, new overseers, and new types of exploited inhabitants. In the past, the Democrats sought to enslave only blacks. Now they seek to turn all of America into a plantation, with every ethnic group dependent on and controlled from a new big house, which is the centralized state. In the book, I will show not merely how the Democratic Party originated as the party of the plantation, but also how the plantation in various forms and adaptations provides the inspiration and model for the evolution of the Democrats right up to the present. If the notion of a Democratic plantation stretching across the entire country seems implausible, let's recall that the man who first predicted it was Abraham Lincoln. In his House Divided speech, Lincoln insisted that Americans would either become all free or all enslaved. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, North as well as South. Lincoln explicitly included whites in his prophecy, arguing that to embrace slavery in principle is to condone the captivity of whites, no less than blacks. Long before me, Lincoln accused the Democrats of his day, or the Democracy as they were then called, of seeking to turn all of America into a plantation. Lincoln's stark dichotomy, a nation entirely free or completely enslaved, was in part inspired by the Democratic champion of slavery as a positive good, George Fitzhugh. Toward the end of his pro-slavery tract, Sociology for the South, Fitzhugh predicted that one set of ideas will govern and control after a while the civilized world. Slavery will everywhere be abolished or everywhere be reinstituted. Fitzhugh, of course, hoped slavery would become universal, and Lincoln hoped it would become extinct. Even so, Lincoln studied Fitzhugh carefully and incorporated his fateful prediction into the House Divided speech. Lincoln's plantation prophecy was not delivered Nostradamus-style as a mere speculation. Rather, it was based on close reasoning drawn from the 1857 Dred Scott decision permitting slavery in the territories. Chief Justice Roger Taney, an Andrew Jackson protege and lifelong Democrat, argued that since the right of property in a slave is distinctly and expressly affirmed in the Constitution, neither Congress nor a territorial legislature could outlaw it. After making the obvious point that the right of property in a slave is not distinctly and expressly affirmed in the Constitution, Lincoln pointed out that, following Dred Scott, the Supreme Court might issue a second decision, concluding by its exact same reasoning that no state could outlaw slavery. In this way, slavery would become legal nationwide, and the way of the plantation would become the American way. It took a mighty war from 1861 to 1865 to prevent this from happening. But it is happening now. My argument holds that Lincoln's nightmare of a national plantation is now being realized, and once again the culprit is the Democratic Party. If the progressive narrative constitutes the conventional wisdom, I will make my case through a rival narrative. Mine will be the unconventional wisdom. I introduce figures that may be new for many, the pro-slavery apologist George Fitzhugh, the man known as the Little Magician, Martin Van Buren, and also familiar figures like Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, and Barack Obama, whom I will reveal in a new light. These are the villains of my story, a very different cast than the villains of the progressive tale, and throughout they are contrasted with the brooding figure of Lincoln, America's first Republican president and her greatest one yet. Lincoln is the hero of my story. And, as in the Civil War period, his philosophical statesmanship defines the American experiment and provides the most penetrating critique of, as well as the best alternative to, the Democratic plantation. It's worth mentioning at this point that this is not a narrative where I have my facts and the other side has its facts. This is not a matter of my truth versus someone else's truths. Throughout this book, I rely on the indisputable evidence of history, drawn from primary sources and from the most reputable scholars of slavery, racism, and fascism. Gordon Wood, David Brian Davis, Orlando Patterson, Eugene Genovese, James McPherson, George Frederickson, A. James Gregor, Ira Katznelson, and others. The facts I present can easily be verified thanks to the technological marvels of the Internet. This body of facts and evidence sets the fixed parameters of debate and narrows the scope for big lies, because while progressives are entitled to their own opinions, they are not entitled to their own facts. In the end, everything turns on whose interpretation of the evidence is right, whether their story or mine is true. This is something that you, the reader, must decide for yourself. You are my judge and my jury. Prison of the Mind. I will admit that at first glance, and for those unfamiliar with my previous work, this argument will seem far-fetched, even crazy. The plantation system, after all, was involuntary. It was based on forcibly confining slaves. Today, the Democrats don't have anyone penned up in this way, and they certainly aren't forcing anyone to work. This objection, however, can be answered by recalling how the antebellum Democrats regarded the old plantation. Democratic Senator James Chestnut regarded his slaves as having it so good on his South Carolina plantation that they cost more than the work they produced. Asked if he ever had runaways, he quipped, "Never. It's pretty hard to keep me from running away from them." Chestnut's wife, the spirited Mary Boykin Chestnut, wrote in her diary in 1861, shortly after the outbreak of the Civil War, "Now, if slavery is as disagreeable to Negroes as we think it, why don't they all march over the border where they would be received with open arms?" Her point was that the slaves who wanted to leave could have left. The white men were all at the front, and there was no one except women and children to stop them. Her deeper implication was that in reality many slaves preferred the security of the plantation to the shock and responsibilities of freedom. The plantation, she suggested, had become not merely a prison of the body, but also a prison of the mind. It held its population in debased psychological confinement, even when there was the opportunity to get up and go. I believe this insight is what drives the modern Democratic Party. The Democrats realized that long after slavery was ended, they could create new types of plantations that would so degrade and imprison the minds of their inhabitants that very few would want to leave. Still, there are massive differences between the old slave plantation and the political life of today's Democrats. The old plantation was rural. Today's Democrats are largely urban. Slavery was largely, though not entirely, a southern institution. Today's Democrats have their base in the north and on the coasts. The plantation was sustained through an ideology of states' rights. Today's Democrats are the party of centralized government that opposes states' rights. If we must draw on analogies from the past, today's Democrats seem closer to Tammany Hall and the urban machines of the North than to the old rural slave plantation. Didn't Franklin D. Roosevelt nationalize those urban machines to create the model of governance for the modern Democratic Party? Yes, but the urban machines were themselves based on the slave plantation. Historians rightly credit Martin Van Buren as the man who invented the Northern Democratic machine. Yet he was the close ally of and immediate successor to Democratic Party founder and Tennessee slave owner Andrew Jackson. Based on his observations of the rural plantation and the similarities he noted between slaves in the South and newly arriving impoverished immigrants in the North, Van Buren adapted the Democrats' plantation model to urban conditions. Thus, he helped to create new ethnic plantations based in the cities, populated by immigrants who were dependent on and exploited by the Democratic Party in the North in somewhat the same manner as the slaves were by the Democrats in the South. These urban machines ripped off the taxpayer, not only to enrich corrupt machine bosses, but also to buy votes in exchange for promises of employment and basic provisions. In sum, the urban machines symbolized by New York's Tammany Hall were themselves mini welfare states, precursors to the Leviathan welfare state Democrats would later establish in the 20th century. As Van Buren's adaptation of the slave system to create the urban machine suggests, this is a story of how the old plantation was creatively modified to produce the modern progressive plantation. I'm not saying the Democrats are the same as they were two centuries ago. This is a story of change as well as continuity. Democrats like Van Buren didn't just extend the rural plantation model from the early 19th century to the present. Rather, they transformed it to changing conditions in response to new demographic realities created by immigrant waves, and also in response to the singular catastrophe that left the old plantation model in ruins. The old plantation was destroyed by the Civil War. Prior to that, the plantation was the model of democratic governance and democratic political domination. Democrats had concocted a whole ideology, the positive good school of slavery, to uphold and defend the plantation. As I will show in the next chapter, this democratic apologia for slavery as an institution to be cherished and expanded was radically different from the founders' shared understanding of slavery as a necessary evil that should be curbed until it could be eliminated. The founders hoped slavery would disappear, and they expected it to. In 1782, Jefferson wrote of a change already perceptible. The spirit of the master is abating, that of the slave rising from the dust, the way, I hope, preparing, under the auspices of heaven, for a total emancipation. Nothing could be further from the vision of the Democratic Party, whose most moderate faction saw slavery as a matter of moral indifference, and an institution that should be continued indefinitely. Interestingly, the Democrats' prime apologist for slavery, George Fitzhugh, was a self-proclaimed socialist who contrasted the happy inhabitants of the Democratic plantation with what he took to be the exploited laboring class of the capitalist Republican northern states. Fitzhugh's arguments seem chillingly familiar because his beloved plantation still shapes the ideology of his 21st century Democratic successors. So does the pro-slavery ideology of Democratic presidential candidate Stephen Douglas, Abraham Lincoln's supreme antagonist. Douglas was a Northern Democrat, and contrary to today's conventional wisdom that views the plantation as a purely Southern creation, Democrats both in the North and the South protected it. Douglas and Fitzhugh were also full-blown white supremacists who railed against blacks in a manner unthinkable of the founders. When Lincoln in his House Divided speech alleged a four-man conspiracy to nationalize slavery, he named just one Southern Democrat, Roger Taney of Maryland, and three Northern Democrats, Stephen Douglas of Illinois, former President Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire, and the current President James Buchanan of Pennsylvania. A few years earlier, Buchanan said that at the time when slavery was besieged throughout the country, slaveholders have no other allies except the Democracy of the North, meaning the Northern Democratic Party. The great support of slavery in the South, said Whig Senator and later Lincoln Secretary of State William Seward, has been its alliance with the Democratic Party of the North. These are the same Northern Democrats that tried to thwart Lincoln during the war. Their goal was to force him to reconcile with the Confederacy and to restore slavery. Lincoln termed them the fire in the rear, more dangerous to the nation than even the Confederate Army. Eventually, through Lincoln's efforts, the ruin of the plantation in 1865 became also the ruin of the National Democratic Party. So the Democrats had to reconstruct themselves after the war. This reconstruction, very different from the reconstruction attempted by Republicans to integrate blacks into the economic and political life of the country, involved not an abandonment of the plantation scheme, but its reinvention, both in the North and in the South. The Democratic urban machine, of course, outlasted the war and continued to hold immigrants in its iron clasp. But for the postbellum Democratic Party of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, sharecropping replaced slavery, and segregation and racial terrorism enforced Democratic control in the South, not just of blacks, but also poor whites. Essentially, the Democrats reinvented the plantation using a new tool of enslavement, white supremacy. Rebuilding the plantation. Progressive Democrats led by Woodrow Wilson sought to rebuild a new type of plantation for the 20th century. They were quite familiar with the old plantation, being just a single generation removed from it. Contrary to the history books, which assiduously camouflage this fact, progressives are the ones who invented white nationalism and white supremacy in their modern and most virulent form for the purpose of keeping poor whites in thrall to the Democratic Party. Progressives, in other words, were America's original hate group. And their opponents, the conservative Republicans, were the original champions of the notion that Black Lives Matter. The other signal contribution of progressivism was to introduce the idea of the centralized state as the big house, with racial terrorism and eugenics as the macabre mechanisms for controlling the population of their new plantation and maintaining quality control for its labor. Through progressivism, Wilson inaugurated, one might say, the birth of a nation that departed radically from the American founding, a new birth represented by the ominous symbol of the night-riding Ku Klux Klan, which served as the domestic terrorist arm of the Democratic Party. Yet it was not Wilson, but his progressive successor, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who in the 1930s and 1940s institutionalized progressivism in the operations of government and thus created the foundation of the modern Democratic Party. FDR began by replacing the Democratic urban machines with the labor union movement and local Democratic Party bosses with a national boss, namely himself. He introduced the idea of a national plantation, Tammany on the Potomac, with a progressive brain trust and progressive administrators as its overseers. FDR also introduced a concept that seems to secretly inspire Democrats to this day, the 100% marginal tax rate. In 1941, FDR proposed a 99.5% tax rate on anyone earning over $100,000 a year. In 1942, he went even further, signing an executive order taxing all personal income over $25,000, which is $300,000 in today's money, at 100%. Even his Democratic Congress balked and lowered the top rate to 90%, even though it crept up to a high of 94% during World War II. FDR insisted that Americans who earned enough to live comfortably should not be allowed to keep any more income beyond that point. Why not take everything they earned above this limit? Although presented as an ideal rather than a policy proposal, FDR's vision, gather up everything you've earned above a certain point and turn it into the government, amounts to nothing less than American serfdom. FDR was the first to seek to implement the Democratic vision of a national plantation. Thus, he laid the foundation for what successive generations of Democrats have to this day pursued. FDR and his team also gave the plantation a fascist facelift, deliberately introducing elements of Mussolini's Italian fascism into the New Deal, while at the same time drawing on models of Nazi conformity, what the Nazis termed Gleichschaltung. Hitler, for his part, created his own plantation, drawing on schemes that he self-consciously lifted from the Democratic Party and from American progressives. Some of the fascist elements first introduced by FDR, both in policy and in strategy, are also evident in today's Democratic Party. Moreover, as Democratic presidents did in the antebellum period, FDR relied on Northern Democrats to play the role they played before the Civil War, namely to ally with Southern Democrats to protect the infrastructure of racism that continued to sustain FDR's National Democratic plantation. Thus, while FDR didn't share Hitler's form of racism, he was not above making a Faustian pact with the worst racists in America to get his New Deal agenda passed. FDR and the Democrats' shameful complicity with fascism and white supremacy are ignored by progressive historians, and virtually no textbook even mentions them. By the 1930s, we can see in FDR's vision of the plantation the familiar outlines that define the Democratic Party today. Today's Democrats have the same attachment to the centralized state, the new big house. And they display the same fascist streak when, for example, they use the instruments of the state against their political opponents. But we cannot stop with FDR. Our story would be incomplete without showing how Lyndon Johnson again modified the plantation in the 1960s, and how Bill Clinton and Barack Obama further expanded it in recent decades. Conversion stories. LBJ was a lifelong bigot who has somehow in progressive historiography been transformed into a convert to the cause of civil rights. From the recently released JFK files, we have good reason to suppose LBJ was once a Ku Klux Klan member. An internal FBI memo refers to documented proof that LBJ was in the Texas Klan during his early political career. If true, this is hardly surprising, and it means LBJ now joins Woodrow Wilson, Harry Truman, and Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black as high-level Democrats who were also Klansmen. Yet we are asked to believe that this leopard magically changed his spots. Apparently a long list of other Democratic bigots, including West Virginia Klansman and Dixiecrat Robert Byrd, who became Obama's and Hillary's mentor, the conscience of the Senate, were also converts to the cause of black equality and advancement. Yet, where are their conversion stories? One might expect that when someone undergoes a wrenching transformation from being a white supremacist to an enemy of white supremacy, they would have quite a story to tell. Whitaker Chambers certainly did when he made the traumatic transformation from communist to anti-communist. Chambers records his intellectual volte-face in his autobiographical magnum opus, Witness. Yet there are no such democratic conversion stories. This is the dog that didn't bark, the clue that tells us that people like LBJ and Robert Byrd never underwent any big transformation. There was no dark night of the soul, no road to Damascus. They merely transitioned from an earlier incarnation of the Democratic plantation to a newer one. LBJ, for instance, remained a priapic plantation boss he was when he started his career. His transformation was purely tactical. He pushed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act not so much to combat an upsurge of white racism, but rather in response to the need for a new approach in the wake of rapidly declining white racism. White racism and white supremacy declined dramatically in the aftermath of World War II. Hitler did more to undermine it than even the civil rights movement, which benefited from the discrediting of fascist doctrines of Nordic supremacy. And this meant LBJ could no longer count on a solid South of white racist Democrats. There were quite simply fewer and fewer of them. Attracted by the message of free markets, anti-communism, patriotism, and upward mobility, non-racist whites in the South had started to move rapidly toward the Republican Party. The Democrats were losing their racist hegemony in the region, and LBJ saw that this represented perhaps the greatest catastrophe for the Democratic Party since Lincoln shut down the old Democratic plantation. Something drastic needed to be done. If the Democrats intended to retain their majority, LBJ saw they needed to get more black votes. This was quite a change for a Democratic Party whose history was largely based on exploiting black labor and suppressing the black vote. But LBJ saw the opportunity to create a new type of plantation in which blacks would be exploited in a different way. On this plantation, they had a different casting role, not as exploited workers who did not vote, but rather as exploited voters who did not work. In other words, LBJ recognized the importance of turning blacks into a constituency, which Democrats had never done before in their party's history. This was LBJ's own Southern strategy, a strategy that required LBJ to turn against his former Dixiecrat allies. It goes unmentioned in progressive historiography, in contrast with Nixon's oft-mentioned Southern strategy, which is largely a myth. Far from campaigning on a racist platform, no one has ever cited a single explicitly racist campaign appeal made by Nixon. Nixon campaigned for the non-racist vote of the rapidly urbanizing peripheral South, leaving the racist vote of the Deep South to George Wallace, the Democratic segregationist who won it. The Republican slogan from the Nixon era, which tagged the Democrats with being the party of acid, amnesty, and abortion, was clearly not about race, but referred instead to the hippie drug lifestyle, to the Vietnam War, and to the permissive 1973 Roe v. Wade abortion decision. Nixon voters were, as in Merle Haggard's famous 1969 song, Okies from Muskogee, who refused to take drugs or dodge the draft and like living right and being free. Whatever this so-called redneck anthem is about, it isn't about racism or white supremacy. True, blacks went from being Republican voters to Democratic voters, and the South went from being solidly Democratic to now mostly Republican, but I prove these transformations had little to do with race. Rather, blacks switched during the 1930s for the economic benefits of the New Deal, and the South became Republican in the 1980s because of the Reaganite appeal of anti-communism, free markets, patriotism, and social issues like family values and opposition to abortion. Far from the parties switching platforms, as progressives contend they did, I show that the ideology of the Republican Party today is essentially the same as it was during the time of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln defined slavery as, "You work, I eat." And that is the core philosophy of today's Democratic Party, no less than the Democratic Party of Lincoln's day. By contrast, the core philosophy of today's GOP is identical with that of Lincoln. I always thought that the man who made the corn should eat the corn. The landmark immigration law of the mid-1960s, which opened the door to 25 million new immigrants, mostly from Asia, Africa, and South America, created the foundation for the Obama plantation, one that encompasses not only blacks, but also Latinos and other minorities. Today's Democratic plantation has come a long way from its roots in the rural antebellum South. It's much bigger now and includes African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, and to some extent even Asian Americans. Today's Democratic plantation is grimly visible in the urban black ghettos, the Latino barrios, the Native American reservations. Obama presided over the Democrats' move toward a multicultural plantation, complete with a sustaining ideology of identity politics that reconciles each ethnic group to its political captivity, seeking to create the modern equivalent of the contented slave. Of course, today's enslaved, while free in principle to leave the plantation, in practice rarely do so. Drawing on the work of psychologist Martin Seligman, I explain this through the concept of learned helplessness. The Democrats have created learned helplessness among their captive constituencies, and this keeps them bound by invisible cords to the plantation lifestyle. There is one important difference between the old Democratic plantation and the new one. The old one was based on forced black labor. The new one is based on the dependent black, Latino, or Native American voter. This voter ideally does not work, but rather lives off welfare and government provision, which becomes, of course, his motive to sustain the providing party in power. Democrats use coalitions of dependent ethnic minorities in order to generate an electoral majority, thus placing progressive Democrats in charge of the big house. From there, they loot the national treasury in the shameless fashion that the old Tammany bosses looted City Hall. Progressive Democrats benefit themselves and live high on the hog, like the Clintons and Obamas, who went from nothing to multimillionaires, from minor overseers to plantation big bosses, all the while declaring as their motive the tireless pursuit of social justice. These Democrats proclaim themselves the benevolent supervisors of needy, impoverished minorities, whom in fact they keep needy and impoverished. These minorities, deprived of education and the skills for advancement, rely on the Democrats to provide for them, thus reducing themselves to dependent subordination and sustaining the progressives in power. Yet despite these differences, the new plantation bears a striking resemblance to its ancient predecessor. In his classic work, The Peculiar Institution, historian Kenneth Stamp identified the five distinctive features of the old slave plantation: dilapidated housing, which the slave owners termed slave quarters, broken families, the product of slave rules that abolished the institution of marriage and permitted the sale of family members at the master's whim. A high degree of violence to police the plantation, necessary, of course, because slavery was based on captive labor. No opportunity for decent education or advancement, notwithstanding the Democrats' insistence on slavery as a school of civilization. And finally, the plantation's pervasive atmosphere of hopelessness, despair, and nihilism. We can identify the existence of Democratic plantations today by finding these exact five features in inner-city Baltimore, St. Louis, Oakland, or Detroit, in the Latino barrios of California and South Texas, and on Native American reservations like the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Other features of the plantation, a class of people who devoted themselves to idleness, leisure, gambling, and duels provoked by petty slights, can also be found in today's ghettos and barrios. In this respect, the inhabitants of these modern ethnic enclaves resemble not so much the old slaves as the old slave owners. Racism's new face. In my earlier books, I have discussed the racist past of the Democratic Party, but I did not directly answer the question, where's the racism of the Democrats today? Here I show that racism remains the core of the Democratic project, but to see this, we must recognize how racism today takes a quite different form than it has in the past. Today's Democrats don't publicly call blacks niggers, nor do they lynch or segregate them as they used to. Today's Democrats, however, are just as indifferent to the plight of blacks as their predecessors, and they create black dependency and exploit black suffering with the same casual indifference as in the past. Today, too, the progressive Democrats have generated a positive good apologia for minority enslavement. While benefiting both financially and politically from the new plantation, these progressives insist they are doing it entirely for the benefit of its inhabitants. Yet, as I show in the last section of the book, there is one group that the Democrats have not managed to enslave: working class whites. This is a group that used to be largely in the grip of the progressives. They were part of FDR's labor coalition. But now they have broken loose, and many of them voted for Trump. I call this group holdouts. Trump is their hero, and this white working class is attracted to his populist American nationalism, both on economic and on cultural grounds. So the Democrats, desperate to conceal their own racism, now seek to discredit working-class whites as bigots and to portray Trump's American nationalism as a thinly disguised resurrection of white nationalism. This is why the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally was so important for them. It confirmed their image of Trump as the apostle of white supremacy and of neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klansmen in Make America Great Again hats as the new face of the Republican Party. Yet, as I will show, the Charlottesville rally was organized by Jason Kessler, a man of the left who used to be an Obama supporter and Occupy Wall Street guy. My interview with America's leading white nationalist, Richard Spencer, reveals that contrary to his portrait in the progressive media, he is actually no conservative, no Republican, no man of the right. In fact, his positions on ethnic nationalism, white supremacy, immigration, and eugenics show him to be a relic of history, a progressive Democrat in the Woodrow Wilson mode. Yet today's Democratic Party has jettisoned the whole eugenic and segregationist agenda of early progressivism in favor of a new plantation model. Spencer is a political activist who has been left behind as his fellow progressive Democrats have evolved into something else. Yet according to the left-wing media account, Spencer is the second most dangerous man in America after Trump. and his ideas could not be more relevant. The entire portrait of white nationalists as conservatives, with Trump and the GOP as their exemplar, is a progressive lie and a deflection. White nationalists like Spencer are decoys of the left, valuable in that they corroborate the big lie of racism and fascism being on the right and draw attention away from the left's own racist exploitation of every ethnic minority group. Still, I do want to explain why some of these white nationalists, insignificant though they might be as a cultural and political force, nevertheless count themselves in the Trump camp. The short answer is that Trump's American nationalism at least makes room for all citizens, while the ethnic nationalism that defines the Democratic plantation today is based on affirming every ethnic group, including minorities who are illegal aliens, except whites. White nationalists who would ordinarily feel at home in a party based on ethnic nationalism find themselves demonized in today's Democratic Party. They are the one ethnic group that is unwelcome at the multicultural picnic. The only role for them in the progressive morality play is as confessors and self-flagellators, a role that some white progressives willingly perform, but one that many white nationalists consider unseemly and degrading. So these people have nowhere else to go except to a party that at least counts them as fellow Americans. Yet if they are in Trump's camp, it does not follow in any way that Trump is in theirs. While Trump is interminably accused of white supremacy for his positions on national security and immigration, the lines that he draws are clearly not racial. On immigration, Trump distinguishes the legal immigrant from the illegal alien. But most legal immigrants today are non-white. They come from Asia, Africa, South America. Trump has said he wants more skilled immigrants. But he has never said he wants more white immigrants from New Zealand and Iceland, and fewer from Barbados and Mumbai. This is confirmed in a telling conversation between Trump and his former advisor Steve Bannon. Discussing the situation of an Asian Indian worker who took his programming skills back to his native country, Trump said, "We've got to be able to keep great people in the country. We've got to be careful of that, Steve. I think you agree with that, Steve." Steve did not necessarily agree, but Trump's position shows that he had no reluctance to go to bat, even for a brown-skinned guy who, in his view, made a contribution to America's economy and prosperity. Similarly, on national security, Trump's resistance to Muslim terrorists and Mexican criminals seeking to infiltrate this country is on behalf of all Americans, not just whites. All Americans, white, black, and brown, are jeopardized when a truck bomb goes off in Times Square or when illegal Mexican gang members go on a crime spree. "I've been greedy," Trump has confessed to his supporters. "I'm a businessman. Take, take, take. Now I'm going to be greedy for the United States." And this is an excellent summation of the man. I close by showing what Trump can do to dissipate the residual force of white nationalism in American politics, while also beginning the much bigger and more important task of dismantling the Democratic plantation. I argued that Trump's American nationalism, correctly defined, offers a remedy for ethnic nationalism of all stripes. If constructed on the Lincoln model, it provides a policy framework for replacing the dependency and hopelessness of the plantation with ladders of opportunity for every American. Far from causing the death of the nation, Trump and the conservatives can come together to show the way for America's restoration, revival, and hope. Chapter 2. Dilemma of the Plantation, the Anti-Slavery Founding. We have the wolf by the ear, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is in one scale, and self-preservation in the other. Thomas Jefferson on Slavery. When San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick first refused to stand for the national anthem, he was asked by NFL media reporter Steve Wyche to explain. "I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color," he said. Kaepernick, of course, is the inspiration for the nationwide NFL protests, in which players take a knee or lock arms or just stay in the locker room during the national anthem. Many fans are outraged, and some are boycotting NFL games, resulting in a measurable drop in viewership. Subsequently, some players who back Kaepernick have attempted a revisionist history of the movement he represents. "It baffles me that our protest is still being misconstrued as disrespectful to the country, flag, and military personnel," frets 49ers safety Eric Reed. Reed insists that the protests are all about police brutality and the criminal justice system. "Yet why aren't NFL players protesting outside police stations? Why choose to spurn the national anthem unless the objection is to what the national anthem represents?" What the national anthem represents is patriotism. It was written by Francis Scott Key in a burst of nationalistic fervor after watching the bombardment of the British fleet during the War of 1812. Key's song was a popular tune for Union troops during the Civil War and became the national anthem in 1916, more than a century after it was written. Its words celebrate American exceptionalism and call upon Americans to rally to the cause of the land of the free and the home of the brave. Kaepernick's progressive admirers across the country know exactly what he's protesting. Noel Ransom in Vice writes that Kaepernick took a knee for all of us in order to expose the harsh reality of white supremacy. Ransom makes it clear that the problem is not confined to the justice system, but is endemic to American history, American institutions, and American life. Leading progressives insist the problem began with the American founding. Speaking on the 200th anniversary of the Constitution, former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall refused to find the wisdom, foresight, and sense of justice exhibited by the framers particularly profound. To the contrary, the government they devised was defective from the start. Marshall urged that instead of jingoistic celebration, Americans should seek an understanding of the Constitution's defects. It's a moral project to trade moral principles for self-interest. Such views are now commonplace. Jefferson didn't mean it when he wrote that all men are created equal, fumed historian John Hope Franklin. "We've never meant it. The truth is that we are a bigoted people and always have been. We think every other country is trying to copy us now, and if they are, God help the world." Franklin argued that by betraying the ideals of freedom, the Founding Fathers set the stage for every succeeding generation of Americans to apologize, compromise, and temporize on those principles. A recent article in Rolling Stone, written in the wake of the Charlottesville controversy, sought to document the history of white supremacy in America. In line with the progressive zeitgeist, the article located the roots of the problem in the American founding, noting that Article 1 of the Constitution says slaves are three-fifths of a person, proving that the United States was founded on white supremacy. To examine whether this progressive critique is correct, we have to resolve the seeming inconsistency, not to say hypocrisy, of slaveholders devoting themselves to freedom, which historian Edmund Morgan terms the central paradox of American history. Morgan is not the first to notice the paradox. It was the premise of the British Tory writer Samuel Johnson's sarcastic jibe at the American founding. "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes?" The best way to answer this question is to turn to a debate on this very topic between Abraham Lincoln and the leading Democrats of his day. They debated it with a seriousness and rigor that surpasses anything written on the subject today. We can hardly do better than to begin with them. Were the founders white supremacists? Did they write slavery and white supremacy into the Constitution? These were the specific issues examined by Supreme Court Justice Roger Taney while writing the notorious Dred Scott decision upholding slavery in the territories. Taney emphasized that in answering these questions, he was not giving his own personal point of view. True, Taney was a Southerner and a Democrat, a protege of Andrew Jackson, but many years previously he had freed his own slaves, and he vehemently objected to the portrayal of him in the Republican press as pro-slavery in his personal beliefs. Taney insisted he was merely interpreting the Constitution according to the intentions of its framers. His objective was to discover what they thought. Taney reasoned as follows. The founders said in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, but their actions showed that they could not have believed it. After all, some 30 of the 55 framers of the Constitution who gathered in Philadelphia were slave owners. So was Thomas Jefferson, who drafted the Declaration. Moreover, far from outlawing slavery, the founders permitted it, and even added a fugitive slave clause that entitled masters to the return of their runaway slaves. If the founders actually meant to include blacks in the Declaration of Independence, Taney wrote, this would make their actions utterly and flagrantly inconsistent with the principles they asserted, and they would deserve universal rebuke and reprobation. Therefore, Taney reasoned, they cannot have meant to do so. It is too clear for dispute, he concluded, that the enslaved African race were not intended to be included and formed no part of the people who framed and adopted this declaration. Rather, in line with a fixed and universal opinion, the framers, according to Taney, regarded blacks as beings of an inferior order. One can see right away that except for a slight difference of emphasis, Taney's reasoning in Dred Scott is identical with that of contemporary progressive critics of the founding. Like him, they argue that the framers were white supremacists who had no intention of including blacks in the Declaration of Independence. This is significant because of what came out of Taney's reasoning, namely his disturbing conclusion that the right to own slaves is expressly affirmed in the Constitution and that blacks have no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Moreover, the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit. Was Taney's constitutional reasoning sound? If progressives today are right about the framers and the Constitution, it follows that Taney was also right about them, because his logic is the same as theirs. And if Taney was right, then Dred Scott was right in affirming that blacks have no constitutional rights and Congress has no power to restrict slavery in the territories. Slave owners have the same right to take their slaves into the territories as they do, say, to exercise their free speech or practice their religion there. Historians are unanimous that Dred Scott also set into motion the events that led to the Civil War. In the words of political scientist Harry Jaffa, it gave an energy, a confidence, and an intransigence to the pro-slavery cause that ended, if it did end, only at Appomattox. Let's recall that the pledge to outlaw slavery in the territories was the main plank of the Republican Party platform in the 1860 election. Dred Scott essentially invalidated the winning party's platform by declaring it unconstitutional. The Supreme Court's conclusion in Dred Scott, in effect affirming a constitutional right to own slaves, was widely hailed by Democrats both in the North and the South. It emboldened the Southern Democrats to press their case for secession, Absent Dred Scott, the South may not have seceded, and the Civil War might have been averted. So if the ruling was legitimate, it seems to follow that the secessionists were right to break away from the Union because of their reasonable fear that Lincoln and the Republicans would overturn their basic constitutional rights. So we are in a remarkable situation today where progressive Democrats agree with Taney that the founders excluded blacks from the Declaration of Independence. They embrace Taney's reasoning for adopting that view. Yet they reject the pro-slavery conclusion Taney drew from that premise. Thus, while they pull down Confederate statues, including at least one Taney statue removed in his native Maryland, they find themselves intellectually in bed with Taney and the Confederacy. This is not entirely surprising, however, because Taney was a Democrat. So were Jefferson Davis, Alexander Stevens, and the leading men of the Confederacy. It seems, then, that modern Democrats are on board with the constitutional reasoning employed by their pro-slavery secessionist counterparts more than a century and a half ago. Catchword of a party. Responding to Taney and Democrats who embraced the Dred Scott decision, among them Stephen Douglas, his famous rival in Illinois, Abraham Lincoln issued one of the most startling challenges in American political history. Addressing Taney's claim that the founders did not regard blacks as included in the Declaration of Independence, Lincoln said, "I believe the entire records of the world from the date of the Declaration of Independence up to within 3 years ago may be searched in vain for one single affirmation from one single man that the Negro was not included in the Declaration of Independence." Naming South Carolina Democratic Senator John C. Calhoun, Lincoln concedes right away that in the recent past there were prominent Democrats who, finding the Declaration's insistence that all men are created equal, constantly in the way of their schemes to bring about the ascendancy and perpetuation of slavery, denied the truth of it. Still, he says, even they did not pretend to believe and then assert it did not include the Negro. But now, for the first time, Lincoln says, the Democratic Party has produced men like Taney and Douglas, who claim that the founders shared an understanding about the Declaration that no living person in their time actually believed. Even more, Lincoln said, their lies about the founders have become the catchword of an entire party. Lincoln's claim is just as much a surprise to the modern reader as it must have been to his contemporaries, because modern Democrats, no less than Taney and Douglas, claim the founders were pro-slavery men who had no genuine intent to include blacks in the Declaration of Independence. Yet Lincoln accused Taney of doing obvious violence to the plain, unmistakable language of the founding documents. So how can Lincoln make such a claim about the founding era? What was he getting at? Lincoln deepens the mystery by repeatedly insisting that as far as slavery is concerned, the entire objective and platform of the Republican Party is merely to restore to America the principal statesmanship of the founders. Lincoln refuses to put any moral distance between him and the founders, between himself, say, and slave owner and Virginia planter Thomas Jefferson. This is fascinating and relevant because there are many today who insist that Abraham Lincoln was a liberal and a progressive, that he took on the radical task of correcting the founding and remaking America. Gary Wills, in Lincoln at Gettysburg, credits Lincoln with a giant swindle, an open sleight of hand in altering the meaning of the Constitution to include people the founders had no wish to include. Yet Lincoln would undoubtedly decline this praise from a left-wing scholar seeking to appropriate him to the progressive cause. Lincoln viewed himself as a conservative. In a speech in Columbus, Ohio, Lincoln said, "The chief and real purpose of the Republican Party is eminently conservative. It proposes nothing save and except to restore this government to its original tone in regard to this element of slavery, and there to maintain it, looking to no further change than that which the original framers of the government themselves expected and looked forward to. Again, in an 1854 speech on the Kansas-Nebraska Act, Lincoln said of slavery, "Let us return it to the position our fathers gave it, and there let it rest in peace." He added in his Cooper Union speech, "This is all Republicans ask, all Republicans desire in relation to slavery. For this Republicans contend, and with this, so far as I know or believe, they will be content." In Lincoln's time, some Democrats tried to portray themselves as conservative and Lincoln as the radical. At Cooper Union, he challenged them. "You say you are conservative, eminently conservative, while we are revolutionary, destructive, or something of the sort. What is conservatism? Is it